This is the inner journey and psychology of Carl Jung, with emphasis on his life and his work and some of his concepts. As you heard yesterday, I'm from Minneapolis and I am a retired therapist. I follow Jung, spelled J-U-N-G, who is a pupil of Freud, because I went to a Jungian analyst after my parents died and got started on the Jungian path, and later studied his work and was more than convinced that he was also a Christian, and that his main emphasis is that we need a spiritual commitment, hopefully a Christian spiritual commitment, so that we may grow to be whole. He is different from Freud in that he does not have fixed symbols in the unconscious that are all sexual, and that he doesn't dwell on childhood trauma, but he starts with a conflict where you are. If you could sit this way, it'd make it a lot easier for me. But doesn't dwell on childhood trauma, but will start with the conflict or the problem where you're at, so that in a Jungian analysis, you sit face to face with the therapist and you talk about your problems and bring in your dreams. And tomorrow and the next 2 days, I'll be talking about the importance of dreams. And on the basis of dreams, which are like a mirror or an X-ray, he can tell where the problem lies and will go back to the problem. But we'll not start with toilet training and weaning, or weaning and toilet training and Oedipal conflicts, as Freudians do, because that takes a lot of time, and I could say money. You see a therapist once a week or twice a week, and in the meantime, you test out some of the insights that you have found, so that it is a forward-looking and a spiritual approach, and therefore, for those reasons, I'm a follower of Jung. He calls his approach analytical psychology, and in order to practice, you have to have an analysis at least, so that you're aware of what you're doing and don't project your own conflicts on your client or patient. What I would like to do first of all is to read a little bit about Jung's life. Jung was born in Switzerland and is an offspring of a whole long line of pastors. So let me read to you from this book, Jung, His Life and Work, by Barbara Hanna. She was a co-worker of his and wrote this very lovingly about his life and his work. Carl Gustav Jung was born in Kesswil, a small village on the Lake Constance in Switzerland, on July 26, 1975. At the present day, 1875, he died in 1961. At the present day, the vicar of Kesswil has had a stone let into the vicarage wall on which he inscribed, "In this house was born Carl Gustav Jung. On July 26th, he died June 6th, 1961. He was an explorer of the human soul and its hidden depths." The hidden depths is what we talk about tomorrow when we talk about the collective unconscious. His father, the Reverend Paul Jung, and his grandfather, Carl Gustav Jung, were prominent members in Basel. And he comes from a long line of pastors, and even his father-in-law was a pastor and a bishop, actually. So he was exposed to a lot of theology and Christian learning. His father, Reverend Jung, married Emily Preiswijk, a girl from an old Basel family, and her father was the vicar of Kesswil, the one whose successor inscribed that stone. Jung writes about his paternal grandfather. He was a striking personality, a great organizer, very active, witty, and a ready command of language, and I still swim in his wake. When constantly heard in Basel, now Professor Jung, he was somebody. His children also tremendously impressed by him, but they did not only respect him, they feared him for what he was, at sometimes a tyrannical father. For example, after lunch, he always had about a quarter an hour sleep, during which his large family had to remain as quiet as mice sitting at the luncheon table. That's typical of German and European families. The father is the person that has to be respected unequivocally, and sometimes he becomes a bit of a tyrannical person. This is important because Jung was named after his grandfather, Carl Gustav Jung, and as he says, I still swim in his wake. He really admired him, and because he was somebody, he patterned himself after him, and Jung today is indeed somebody. Parenthetically, he has written 17 volumes on the structure of the psyche, on dreams, on alchemy, on has written an autobiography, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections, has written Modern Man in Search of a Soul, and the most popular book that Jung has written is called Man and His Symbols. How many of you are familiar with that book? Has anybody seen it? All right. There's a big volume that has beautiful illustrations. It's worth getting. It's a nice Christmas present. There's also a paperback that is quite adequate. And that is his last work. It was written when he was about 80 years old. No, 84, I guess. And he had been approached to write a popular book because most of Jung's writings are very esoteric and Germanic in the way that means that, you know, you talk, and then there's a verb at the very end, and the translator had an awful time getting it into understandable English. So he was approached and asked to write a popular book. He said, oh no, I've done my work. At 84, who wants to write another book? But that night he had a dream, to show you how important dreams are. And in that dream, he was standing in Liverpool, I believe, or whatever city, and talking to a group of blue-collar workers. Now, he had always addressed academicians. He'd always addressed people who were high-status, white-collar people, and he talked their language. Well, in this dream, he spoke to these workers, and they not only understood him, but were enthusiastic. Well, the next morning after he had this dream, he called the man who had approached him from the BBC and said, I believe I am called to write yet another book, and that is Man and His Symbols, its last legacy. He wrote it with some co-workers, so it is not all his own writing, but every part of it was edited and supervised by him. And it is quite understandable. It is the book that a layman would enjoy reading. Well, back to his life. His maternal grandfather was a bishop of Basel, and he is said to have had second sight, or ESP, which is a gift. Jung wrote about his maternal grandfather, I did not know him personally, but from everything I heard, his name, the Old Testament name of Samuel, must have suited him very well. He still believed that Hebrew was the language spoken in heaven, and therefore devoted himself with greatest enthusiasm to the study of Hebrew language. But with two such grandfathers as his models, they were his models more than his father. His father and his mother had a difficult but typical marriage. When a child grows up in the vicarage, any of you who are children PKs probably know what that means. It's awfully hard to see your father preach in the pulpit and then to see him at home as more or less genuinely kind. I mean, sometimes that is a difficult place to be. Moreover, he was always called the parson's son. He was never called Carl Jung when he went to school. And whatever he did, people eyed him very carefully. Now, psychologists' children are in a similar boat, and somehow, I don't know why, they expect the children of pastors and children of psychologists to turn out better. We're only human, but we seem to, they expect us to know more or to do better. Anyhow, Jung had two grandfathers that he patterned himself after, and a father who was a very strong and highly respected man in the church. It was a Lutheran church in Basel. He went to a typical gymnasium, that's the high school, and got a very thorough education. He thirsted for knowledge. He loved to study, and he felt one of the greatest burdens was not to understand something. He was a teacher's delight because he would not cease until he really grasped what they were talking about. And later in his writings, he probed deeply into his own unconscious. In fact, much of his writing comes from what he found in his own unconscious as well as what he had studied. And at all times, he was completely honest with himself, no matter how unpleasant the truths that he unearthed. He went to Basel University and he practiced at the Burghölzli Psychiatric Hospital, which was the prominent hospital, and he worked with prominent psychiatrists. And in his lifetime, I'm jumping ahead, he analyzed some 80,000 dreams. That's a lot of dreams. He also had a book in which he drew pictures from his dreams. It's called The Red Book, and it's almost like the Book of Kells. It's very special. And some people felt that he had real artistic ability, but he always denied that. However, some of you, when you write down your dreams, might find it easier to draw the dream or the figure than to write it out, because that is the way you perceive it. He trained at the psychiatric hospital, and then he went to Küsnacht, which is on Lake Constance, where he lived by the lake. He always wanted to live near water, and he not only lived in a house, but he built a tower with his own hands. He was a stonemason, if you can imagine that, as well as having a well-appointed kitchen, and he did some fantastic gourmet meals, almost as good as what we had tonight. Actually, he was very accomplished, both as a stone carver, a chef or a cook. People loved to come and sit, and he would talk by the hour. And of course, he was an eminent psychotherapist as well as lecturer, so he was all-rounded. In 1914-18, during World War I, he went through immense struggles, internal struggles, that mirrored, he felt, the terrible conflict out in the world. Now, Switzerland was neutral, so he had kind of a distant view. Nobody in his family had to go to war, nor did he, and he could, he kind of resonated, that's a good word among Jungians, resonated the conflict out there in his inner life. Then in 1925 and 1926, he went on some remarkable journeys. He was in America, first off, to be a lecturer at Clark University. He and Freud both were invited to come, and they worked together for some time, but fell out. They did not agree on dream interpretation. And Freud was in some ways too much of a father figure. He was quite a bit older and wanted Jung to be his totally obedient disciple and follower. And Jung was much too original in his thinking to follow him totally. But that does not mean that Freud was not a pioneer and didn't pave the way for some very fine research and work. So Jung was in America in 1925, and wanted to see the Indians, the Pueblo Indians, and he traveled out to New Mexico and studied them and was delighted. He has some examples that are just amazing of some of the myths and stories that the Indians told that again mirrored or resonated with what he had found among the dreams of his psychiatric patients in Switzerland. And I don't know if it was then or later that he coined the word synchronicity, something that happens at the same time in different places but has an inner connection. And synchronicities can be as small as a little coincidence of meeting somebody from the same town at Holden as something that I just mentioned, coming across the same myth or the same concepts among Pueblo Indians and patients in the psychiatric hospital. That's almost far-fetched, yes. Oh, all right. Is this better? Oh, all right, I'll bring it here. I don't like microphones, I'm sorry. Is that better? All right, okay. Any questions while I take off my jacket? Okay, I'd like to read something from his journeys. I forgot to mention, after the Pueblo Indians, he went to Africa. And it was amazing that this journey could be arranged at such a short notice. Two Americans and an Englishman did all the legwork and the arranging for him, because he really was well known and quite prominent, and he thought that he needed to go to a country that was still on a more primitive level. And in his travels to Africa, he found confirmation, again, among the primitive tribes for some of the things he had experienced himself and had seen in dreams of his patients. In the African journey was probably one of the happiest times in Jung's life. Quote, "My companions and I had the good fortune to taste the world of Africa with its incredible beauty and incredible suffering." That's still true today. "Our camp life proved to be one of the loveliest interludes in my life. I enjoyed divine peace of the primeval country. Never had I seen so clearly man and animals. Thousands of miles lay between me and Europe. No demons could reach me here. There were no telegrams, no telephone calls, no letters, no visitors." Almost like Holden. "My liberated psychic forces poured blissfully back to the primeval expanses." You get the essence of the man in this writing. And in another passage about Africa, he says, "My stay at Mount Elgon at dawn, when the sun first comes up over the horizon, the natives emerged from their huts, spat on their hands, turned their palms upward toward the sun. They could not explain this action. It was just what they had always done. But then, as he pointed out, nor can we explain candles at Christmas time or colored Easter eggs. Finally, he realized someone told him that it was at the rising of the sun, at the moment that the sun rises above the horizon, that they saw God, that they called the sun God or Mungu. At the same time, he discovered that the new moon also was called God by the tribes. The Elgoni never worshipped the sun or the moon at any other time except at the moment that it rises. And when they spit into their hands, that is part of their soul, and it is as though they said, wordlessly, I offer God my living soul. And Jung felt that it was similar to our phrase, Lord, into thy hands I commit my spirit. So you see how spiritual this man was. I thought this was an unusual passage because they were not sun worshipers, but it was a moment that light overcomes darkness that they worshiped God. And when you watch the dawn, I often have that feeling myself. I think I should go on to talk about some of his concepts. He was a very thorough researcher, and he postulated mostly that we always live in a tension of opposites. That's why the title, Reconciling Opposites. And earlier, there's a tape in the library about paradox. Our life is riddled with paradox. And you don't have to look very far between night and day, inner and outer, love and hate, whatever. You will find paradox. There's always a tension. We want to be always on the side of light, but it's not possible. Or always loving. That's really not possible. We have to admit that there are sometimes dark things that will come up in our psyche. And he postulated that to the extent that you can tolerate the tension and live these opposites and recognize that it's not this or that, but that it is this and that. And this reconciliation liberates psychic energy and helps us to live more peacefully and more honestly with each other. He described the psyche, our whole being, as an iceberg. This is an analogy. The ego is just the tip of the iceberg. Consciousness is just the tip of the iceberg. 4/5 is unconscious. Part of the unconscious can be brought up. Many things we forget can be raised because our memory, if we try very hard, we can bring it up or we can search back and remember. But most things in the unconscious can only be seen through the dreams, and that's why I said the dreams are like a mirror. And if you don't remember dreams, it says nothing other than that you don't need to remember them or don't want to remember them, because you do dream about 5 times a night and they keep you sane. It's sort of like clearing an adding machine. The mind has to be cleared of all that's taken in during the day. And just as the body has to rest, so the mind has to be cleared. So dreaming has a very vital function physiologically, psychologically. If you remember your dreams and keep a dream diary, you will see a pattern. You'll see a kind of red thread going through, pointing the way, warning, bringing up healing symbols, and telling you things that are unique to you that you need to hear. And Kelsey and Sanford and others maintain that the Holy Spirit can and does speak to you through dreams, as he did at the key points in the Bible, and we'll talk about that tomorrow, some of the biblical dreams in the Bible, where if Joseph hadn't had the dream, he would not have taken Mary and would not have gone to Egypt. And Joseph in the Old Testament interpreted the dreams for Pharaoh, and that was very important. But I'll leave that for tomorrow. I want to talk about the psyche, okay? Are you still with me? Any questions? Okay. The ego, then, consciousness is like the tip of the iceberg. And the way we work in, the way we act in life is through what he calls the persona, or the mask. Now, a mask is usually seen as something that hides the true self. But what he postulated was that it's like the actor's mask through which you speak, and the more honestly you speak from your center, the more your mask is a fitting mask. Sometimes if the mask is askew, I don't know if you've ever tried masks, where maybe there are no nose holes and you can't breathe, or the eye slits are so small you can't see. Anyhow, using that analogy, the persona is like a mask through which you speak. And specifically, it means if I ask any of you, where do you come from? You'll tell me where you came from. Then I say, what do you do? And you will tell me what you do or how you spend your time. This is your persona. This is how you relate to other people. This is how you relate to the world. It would take a much deeper and longer conversation to get to some of the inner things, and probably you would not right away talk about it. However, here at Holden, I have found that many people come up, and before we know it, we're talking about dreams or some inner experience that has been very vital in their life. If anyone has a special dream, I'll be glad to talk to them. Another concept that is very important for Jung is the shadow. That is the dark side, that which we hide, that which we cannot admit, that which we dislike about ourselves. That part which, when you are married, you even hide from your spouse or are very ashamed of revealing, but which is part of you and needs to be at least acknowledged. It cannot be totally refined. Unfortunately, even in therapy, not all of the shadow side can be transformed. Maybe one-third or half of it, half of that energy. Some of it has to simply be acknowledged as that's the way I am. And if you love someone, you love them warts and all. Another aspect of the unconscious is that it contains what he called the archetypes, spelled A-R-C-H-E, types, T-Y-P-E-S. Archetypes are general predispositions, and again, I'll talk about that tomorrow in much greater detail when I have a blackboard on which I can illustrate this. Examples of the archetypes are the great mother, the great father, the hero, the child, the trickster, which is sort of a little imp, the devil himself, and the great events in our life, think the concept of death, of birth, and rebirth. Those are all archetypes. We find them also in myths and fairy tales. Numbers, 3, 7, 4. In fact, I think 7 is a holy number because it consists of 3 plus 4, and 3 is the Trinity, and 4 is wholeness, according to Jung. Then he postulated 2 more concepts, the anima and the animus. Anima is the feminine side in a man, the feminine counterpart that many men have had to suppress, even repress, until very recently. I think now it's okay for fathers to nurture, diaper children, even cry, cook, be domestic, doing lots of things that women do. The other part of it is the animus, which is the masculine side in women. And that too has been repressed over the ages because women were meant to stay home, take care of the children, and never to have big opinions, you know, or write poetry. You never call a woman, didn't used to, a poet, you call her a poetess, which was a put down. Today, I think women are much more equal. They can express their animus side, their masculine side, and are certain. It has nothing to do with intelligence. It has to do with assertiveness, logic, intellectual and other pursuits. I mean, I always think of it in terms of intellectual pursuits because that's where I come from. But a woman is now accepted as a person who has the equal ability to have a career just as a man has. Any feminists in the audience who want to speak up on this? I think you're an older generation. Any questions at this point? Okay, I must be making myself clear, I guess. Let's see. When I opened the series on inner journeys, I wrote on the board, we have this treasure in earthen vessels. We have this treasure in earthen vessels. And my point here is that as we grow older, we need to spend more attention to our treasure and not spend as much time on our bodies, or not worry so much when our bodies don't do what they want, what they used to do. Our inner nature is renewed daily. Work at it alone. It's just so many words that float out there and then get lost. Our pastor always says, take one verse and chew on it all day while you go on a hike or walk and so forth. And it really is very salutary because it helps us, in a sense, to pray unceasingly as we are urged to do in the Bible. The reason I'm talking about this is that if you don't feed the treasure, don't feed your soul, then it will become, the light inside will become dimmer and never quite extinguished, but it's the saying, don't put your light under a bushel, but put it up. So similarly, you have to feed your inner psyche, your inner soul, so that your light might shine forth, so that you don't bury or shroud it. And the task of your second half in life is precisely to feed this treasure, to nourish it, so that you can look forward joyfully for your eternal life. Many people are afraid of the dark side and defend against it. And again, there is a term called defense mechanism. We defend against too much prying. We defend against too much probing. And we unconsciously defend against letting other people see this dark side. And one way that is very common is called projection. I'm sure you've heard of projection. We take something, possibly part of our dark side, and project it onto someone else. I'm always looking in your direction, I'm sorry. Project it onto someone else, and then gossip and say, that lady, well, whatever you hear in this dark, in this gossip, is usually what you can't accept in yourself. It's kind of an interesting exercise to listen with the third ear as to what people are gossiping about. That's the negative side of projection. What's the positive side? That's falling in love. You project this image onto someone, and suddenly this person is superhuman, is just, there's nothing that this person can do wrong. You're floating on air, you're just smiling, you're singing, you're happy, because you found this person on whom you can project all the wonderful ideal qualities that you carry around in your soul. But sometime it happens, sooner or later, that the person shows you some of their dark sides, or is doesn't quite fit, the image doesn't quite fit, and then you sort of fall out of love. And that is so unfortunate, because at that point, the real love starts. You love the person because of all his or her qualities, not because this projected image. And when you have children, they come home and say they've fallen in love. Most of the time, they're infatuated and merely projecting some of the ideals onto another person. And you need to counsel them to get to know the real person underneath. And then if they can still love the real person, then a relationship is possible. Sometimes in marriage, when you come to that point, you don't try hard enough to reestablish communication and drift apart, and today you know how many divorces there are. Every relationship goes through this wonderful projection, falling out of love, reestablishing communication, loving the person, then seeing another aspect, falling apart again and coming together. And this goes on through life. And I think it's very exciting. We've tried it for 34 years, with more or less success, and we're still together. Any questions? You've all heard of the word extroversion and introversion. And in my session on Friday, I believe, I'm going to have different groups talk about how they perceive themselves as extroverts or introverts. And I'll just briefly talk about it now. Jung coined this term while he was working in that psychiatric hospital because he noticed that some patients and people he knew received their energy from other people, other things, not just people, but other things, and gave it back. So that the exchange was from the outward in. That's the extrovert. The introvert starts from the inner and projects outwardly or deals with it outwardly, spends a lot of time writing journals, mulling over experiences, making transitions very slowly. That's one of the key things to note, that whether you make the transition from one activity to another easily or need to work it through, whether you need to write a journal at night before you go to sleep or whether you just hit the pillow and go to sleep. I mean, those are real differences. The extrovert is not necessarily happy-go-lucky and loving people, because introverts can love people just as much. But there's an initial shyness, an initial drawing back. Also, the introvert tends to like one or two deep relationships and looks at the extrovert and says, he's superficial. That's not true. He's just able to deal with many different people. And the extrovert looks at the introvert and says, must you spend so much time analyzing it in such depth, you see? And I've experienced both these things, of course. The therapist often deals with people who have been forced into a mold. Let us say you have very extroverted parents, and the child is predisposed to be an introvert. Parents keep saying, hey kid, come out, play baseball, do this, when the kid really would like to read and be alone, not pathologically alone, but really in depth analyze something. Jung was an introvert, as you could tell. And the parents pull out the child, and to please them, and because he can't help himself, he follows and is never quite comfortable. He feels somewhat in a straitjacket because he's made to adapt to a way that is not natural. The reverse, if the parents are very introverted, let us say they're, I like to use scholars, but not necessarily. They like to sit and read. Maybe they're older too. And this kid is dying to go out, and the parents keep saying, maybe making him even fearful, because it's not their natural mode. And so he may find companions with whom he can do it, and we hope he does, he or she, but he will not get the same approval as if he stayed home and read the book in depth, you see? So there's something for you to think about vis-a-vis your own children. And in our exercise, we'll talk about that tomorrow too. We have about 10 more minutes before Vespers, yes. You're asking whether it is whether a person is born into this mode rather than nurtured into it. Yeah, a predisposition. Yeah. Well, you all know how children, babies are different. There are those who are just alert and think sleeping is not something they want to do, and others who are quite content to play hour by themselves. I had some of each. And I had two that played, they're now artists, incidentally. They played by themselves by the hour. Then the third one came along, And all he wanted to do was to be running around and doing things out there, and he didn't like the idea of playing in a playpen or playing with blocks, you see. So, a predisposition, yes, and not fixed in stone, but definitely a predisposition. And something that the young people tend to be more extroverted by and large, because they have to make a living. The second half of life, as a balance, should be more introverted. And people can balance it in different seasons of their life. It's not fixed in stone, but it's definitely a predisposition. I see some people coming in for Vespers already. Any other questions? Yes, okay, I'll try to. This is the thrust of the whole inner journey theme. Because you, as you grow older, need to make less adjustments on the outer, in the outer life, it behooves you to nurture the inner life and to nurture the introverted side of yourself, especially if you've been very extroverted in your first half. But paradoxically, again, if you've been a real extrovert as an introvert as a youth, it might be the time when you want to be very active in your second half. It's a balancing thing. And it's, as I said before, it's not fixed in stone, it's a predisposition. And you can nurture it. It can be nurtured. Yes? Yeah, I know. That's what we'll have our exercise tomorrow in the smaller session, and it gets to be lots of fun as well. In those, which areas are you extroverted, which areas are you introverted? It's a predisposition, but where do you feel more comfortable? And that's another touchstone. Where do you feel more comfortable? And how easily do you make these transitions from one activity to another? And if there are no more questions, perhaps we should get ready. Yes? That's fascinating. You asked, I'm saying this for the tape, you asked whether people could make connections between the kinds of parties they're attracted to and charismatic other religions. There is a book on Jung and politics, and I will think about it, and I'll give a better answer tomorrow. There is some connection, but not a one-to-one, naturally. And as my statistics teacher never ceased to repeat to us, correlation is not causality. If two things are correlated, that does not mean that one causes the other. And we have to be very careful about that. And I'd like to leave you with the last thought that Jung wrote over his door. He carved in stone and in Latin the saying, whether we call on God or not, God is there, abides with us.